Epictetus is talking to his students and they ask him, well, you know, why are humans special? There's a paraphrase, and then quote, the student asks, is it not the case that animals too are works of God? And Epictetus responds, indeed they are, but they're not of primary value, nor are they portions of the divine. But you, for your part, are of primary value. You are a fragment of God.
Welcome to Stoic Conversations. My name is Caleb Ontiveros.
And I'm Michael Tremblay.
And today we are going to be talking about the Stoic God. It's one of those issues that anyone who's reading any of the classic Stoic authors must come across, this talk of God, nature. And Michael put together a great set of notes for us to go over, you know, what did the Stoics actually mean when they talk about God? What's the Stoic view? So that's what we're going to be doing today.
Yeah, I think this is a cool topic because one thing that's always interesting when you're studying Stoicism or any sort of ancient tradition is being cautious about not putting contemporary ideas onto things. Well, so when the Stoics talk about the mind or the Stoics talk about a soul, it can be very tempting to try to think about those in the ways that the average person today might talk about them. And I think that's especially dangerous when it comes to God. Also, because this is coming from a tradition that I think is outside of the Judeo-Christian tradition. So it doesn't share a lot of the same conceptions or norms that are most common today. The other thing that I think, I think we want to get that right so we can actually understand what the Stoics are talking about. The other reason this is important, I think, is that the Stoic God, as you said, is very central to a lot of what the Stoics talk about. And we can sometimes gloss over that or skip over that, especially if we're not religious ourselves, or we come to studying Stoicism or an interest in Stoicism, not from a religious perspective. But I always think when you're studying anything, there's what the Stoics thought, there's what the truth of the matter is, and then there's maybe, you know, what you think about the Stoics or what we think about the Stoics. And we're always trying to have what we think about the Stoics come as close to the truth as possible. And then we can use that as a tool to try to understand what the truth of the matter actually is. But regardless of where you're going to land in your practice or your way of interacting with Stoicism, we want to try to get that Stoic position right, even if we disagree with it, even if it seems strange, or maybe it doesn't, and it seems really helpful and interesting and valuable. And I think depending on, you know, where the people listening, where you fall on the way you think about God, either as atheists or a contemporary religion or something in between, there's going to be, I think, a wide range of reactions from that doesn't make sense to that's really cool to I don't understand, you know, where that comes into ethics or how we live. But to do any of those questions, we have to kind of just get down what the Stoics are talking about. So interested to do that today. I had four ways I was going to structure this. First, a quick recap on Stoic physics, because that's important to understand what the Stoics are talking about when they're talking about God. Then this question of what is God? How do the Stoics think about God? What does that mean for us? Then a discussion of conflagration, which is a really important Stoic idea about the cyclical nature of the universe and God's relationship in that, and then a summary. And before I kick things off, Caleb, I always have a goal in these episodes to explain these ideas as clearly as possible, but that's extra my goal for this episode. So maybe, you know, hold me extra to it as we're talking about this, because I think that I want my language to be as clear as possible, because I think sometimes when you don't understand something well, or something is complicated or confusing, it can be easy to kind of obscure it in language. I think, you know, I want it to be talking about God in as clear and simple terms as possible, not obscure what we're talking about, not make it more complicated than it needs to be. Sometimes it will be complicated, but not making it more complicated than it needs to be. Trying to always hold ourselves to that standard of just a clear explanation.
I'm excited to get into it. I think one way to think about it is what we're going to try to do in this episode is understand how the Stoics thought about God. And I think it's debatable exactly how central God is to the Stoic picture. That's not a debate we'll be hopping into for this episode. I think what we can say is that both for several ancient Stoics, philosophy and practice, it absolutely was essential. And even for some modern Stoics, perhaps that God plays an essential role in their picture. So our primary purpose, I suppose, isn't to hop into debates about whether that's right, but get a sense of what especially these ancient Stoics are talking about. And along the way, I'm sure we can touch on some issues of how that influenced their practice, how that influenced their day-to-day Stoicism as well.
Yeah, great. Cool. So let's kick things off. I wanted to start off with just a refresher on Stoic physics. We've talked about this before, but just a quick recap, because it is a bit weird. So first things first to understand is that the Stoics were materialists. So everything, which just means that they think that everything that exists is matter. So you might think that this makes them an atheist, or there's nothing besides matter. It doesn't just if God exists, it has to be material in form. God has to be material. That's what materialism commits them to. And then there is this in their materialism. There's two different kinds of matter. So there's the matter that is active, and then the matter that is passive. And so the matter that is passive, I would say, takes up space, has kind of mass and dimensions, but is inert. And then the matter that is active is really what gives that shape, or gives that kind of passive matter its form, gives the passive matter any kind of energy, movement, direction. Stops there from being just passive things. It's like any sort of active movement is attributable to this active matter. And so these call this the active and the passive principle. And the reason they call it, I guess, the active and the passive principle is that you never actually find these two kinds of things separate. So you have your passive principle and your active principle, and then they both come together to make matter. I don't think it's conceptually impossible to imagine just passive matter. But the Stoic answer is that you would never have just the passive principle. Anything that there is matter. It has both this passive and this active aspect of it. And then it is active matter, the active principle, which is in all matter, along with the passive principle, which is considered by the Stoics described to be intelligent and described to be connected with God. And I think that's about as far as we got in our primer on Stoic physics last time. So everything is matter, that there can still be a God, the same way the Stoics would talk about a soul. It just has to be matter. Can't be a different kind of thing. Matter is made up of an active and passive principle. And then that active principle is associated with God and intelligence and the kind of movement, structure, and the laws of the universe as well. So that's the refresher. Anything to add on that?
Well, one question I have is, to what extent does this distinction between active and inactive matter map onto Aristotle's account of causation? The idea, you have these four different causes of something. You have the material cause, something of that's the matter out of which it was made, the formal cause, the account of what it is to be, the efficient cause, which is sort of often, I think, how we think about causes today, the thing that caused it to be, and then finally the final cause, which is its end, its purpose, its telos. So a quick example of this would be if you have a statue or something of that sort, the material cause is just the clay. If you have someone forming the statue, the formal cause is there's an order to it, right? It takes on a form, the form of a statue. The efficient cause is a person who models the clay. They're working with their hands. They cause, they didn't in a sense define what it is to be a statue, but they've imposed the form on this matter. And then finally, that person might have some goal in mind, or perhaps even statues serve some larger goal for the sake of beauty or something of that sort. So that's a quick example of a quick run through, I guess, of Aristotle's four causes. But it does seem like many of these have that active element to it. So I was curious what you think about that.
Yeah. So I mean, the active principle is associated. I'm not terribly familiar with Aristotle. I mean, that was a clear description, but the active principle is associated with the cause. You know, so that I have some quotes here. Diogenes Laertius says, the Stoics think there are two principles of the universe, that's the active and passive, that which acts and that which is acted upon. That which is acted upon is unqualified substance. That which acts is the reason, i.e. logos, in it, i.e. God. So you have this kind of, so you have this, the active principle there is being associated with the cause, or being associated with you know, giving things its shape. There's another one here by Sextus Empiricus that gets right into causes. The substance of what exists, the Stoics say, since it is without any motion from itself and shapeless, needs to be set in motion and shaped by some cause. For this reason, as when we look at a very beautiful bronze statue, we want to know the artist. So when we see the matter of the universe moving and possessing form and structure, we might reasonably inquire into the cause which moves and shapes it into many forms. It is not convincing that this is anything other than a power which pervades it, just as a soul pervades us. Now, this power is either self-moving or moved by some other power, but if it is moved by another power, the second power will not be capable of being moved unless it is moved. It's kind of an, you know, a never-ending cycle. So then the power which moves matter and guides itself, must be everlasting, and this power must be God. It can't be kind of an ending cycle. It must be kind of this, the unmoved mover, which I think is another Aristotelian idea there.
Yeah. So the Stoic idea, we can perhaps say, has some initial similarities with Aristotle's picture of, you know, it's also talking about form, causation, but it's more fundamental, I think, in the sense that when the active principle is sort of the driving, organizing force of matter, whether that's giving matter its form, or if we want to talk about causation and other ideas about order, structure, and so on, it's the thing that brings about structure, order, and form. Does that seem right?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's also the cause of anything to be anything rather than nothing, right? Like the reason, that active principle is the reason, I mean, we'll get into this a bit later, but it's the reason why a rock holds its shape. It's the reason why things move, and any sort of motion or form or direction is all set in motion by this active principle and then sustained by the active principle. I think the easiest thing is to think about what it would be like without an active principle. And I guess it would just be kind of like, maybe it would be like a random distribution of material that takes on no form or shape and has no movement. Like that would be passive principle only in passive matter.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist because all of that matter is imbued with this active principle, this active component of matter, which gives a cause to literally all the motion in the universe, all the form, all the kind of chemical laws, all of the, any sort of kind of causal forces that apply on each other and relate to each other. The fact that objects bounce off one another because they have a kind of mass and shape that allows these causal relationships, that's all requires that kind of, that active principle.
All right. All right. Yep. That makes sense. That makes sense to me. It's cool. An abstract idea, but it makes sense.
Yeah. It's tough. I'm trying my best here. I find it very difficult. Much more difficult than the ethics. So then, you know, I always say the active principle is associated with God, but what is God? Is there some sort of definition here? Is it just the active principle? Like, what were the Stoics thinking of when they think of God? And so here's a quote from Aetius, who was a, you know, first, second century AD source on the Stoics. And he said, the Stoics made God out to be intelligent, a designing fire which methodically proceeds towards the creation of the world and encompasses all the seminal principles according to which everything comes about according to fate, and a breath pervading the whole world, which takes on different names owing to the alterations of matter through which it passes. So this is a lot. But first, we have out the idea that God is intelligent. I mean, what intelligence means here, we can discuss further, but God is intelligent. So A, God exists. B, God is intelligent. God is the designing fire, which pervades the whole world and methodically proceeds towards the creation of the world as it is, and doesn't just produce, but encompasses the principles according to which everything comes about. So that's the things I was talking about the kind of the laws of physics, the laws of causation, the way that matter interacts with each other to produce this causal chain. That's all considered to be God. And so I think the key metaphor here, so we have that active principle, but I think the key metaphor that might make it easier to understand is that idea of the breath pervading the whole world. And so if you think about it like from a Stoic sense, if you imagine an individual person, and breath here is pneuma, which is like a very specific word for that kind of hot breath. And humans were considered to have a pneuma. It was associated with their soul. And so if you imagine an individual person whose breath is then associated with their heat or their energy, so what makes it's something that they have when they're around and they're moving and they're alive. And when they die, they were thought to kind of lose that breath. They lost that pneuma. And so they go from this active, intelligent, moving being with designs and motions and goals, and then they die, and then they become a kind of passive corpse. They become cold, because they've lost that breath which flows through them. They're a lump of flesh, right? Decaying. And so when they have the breath, they're unified, inspirited, they're acting towards a greater end. So God is that breath, it's that pneuma for the whole cosmos, for the whole universe. It's that thing that imbues passive matter with movement, but also form and necessary laws. So it's that active principle, but I think active principle is abstract. You think about it as the energy of the physical universe. And when we think about energy, literally down to, you know, the energy that's spent, if you think of entropy as the kind of dissipation of all energy, it's the energy that's spent that kind of causes the sun to shine, causes the plants to grow, causes humans to metabolize their food, causes the planets to orbit the sun. So all that kind of energy is the result of that active principle imbuing the universe with motion, force, energy, as I said. And then in the Stoic view, that's all kind of also unfolding towards a specific goal, design, or plan. So that energy is then unfolding towards a specific desired ends, namely the intelligent, ultimately good providential ends, the thing that the God wants, the best possible universe. And so one more thing on that. So the Stoics, this thing, so that's the kind of the designing fire, the hot breath. That's what's associated with God. And that is different from literal fire. It's this kind of metaphorical thing that provides energy. So another quote here, this time from Diogenes, I believe. Zeno says that the sun and the moon and each of the other stars are intelligent and prudent and have the fieriness of designing fire. For there are two kinds of fire. One is undesigning and ventures fuel into itself. The other is designing, causing growth and preservation, as is in the case in plants and animals, where it is physique and soul respectively. Such is the fire which constitutes the substance of the stars. And so that's just that idea that even if we look at something like the sun, the Stoics are seeing, you know, there's that literal burning, the literal fireness of the sun, but then it's also participating in the designing fire, that active principle, that breath that is associated with God. And that is different than regular fire, which burns itself up. This is the designing fire, which causes growth and also preservation. It also keeps things the way they are. So did my best to get that down. Any thoughts on that, Kill?
Yeah, I think the breath metaphor is really helpful. And I suppose to extend that metaphor further, something that the Stoics talk as if the whole universe, nature itself, is an organism itself. So you can then ask, totally, what's the driving force behind that organism? And connect it with, times when, say, Marcus Aurelius is doing the view from above practice and noticing how parts relate to the whole, how they play this greater part in a larger system, whether that's the flecks of foam on a boar's mouth, the cracks of in a loaf of bread, whatever it is. God is that sort of fundamental, life. You could almost say life force, perhaps. Though that word has other connotations as well. I think that gets at, is another way to get at the same idea.
It really is the life force. I think there's, as you said, modern connotations to that, but it is that. So it's not the idea of why there is something instead of nothing, because it's not clear to me the Stoics think without God you wouldn't have inert passive matter. But it is the reason that something looks like anything at all, right? That looks like planets and stars and humans and cats and dogs and plants, right? It's because it's imbued with this life force, which is understood as both, you could both think of it as like literal heat, right? Like energy. But also what's captured in that is again, back to that original quote, the seminal principles according to which everything comes about according to fate. So also these like physical laws of nature, these rules, those are all understood to be kind of determined and produced by God, as this kind of this energy of the universe or this breath of the universe. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, even just getting to that part, that's a pretty... Sometimes even myself, I say, or I'll think like, oh, the Stoics think that God is the universe. And it's important, I think, to remember that that's not necessarily the case, that they think of it as that life force, as that designing energy within it.
That's a good point. It's close to the idea that God is the universe or God is everything, but it's not exactly the same thing. It's not to say that God is identical with the universe. It's a specific aspect of the universe.
A specific part of the universe that you couldn't, there's nothing out there that couldn't have, that doesn't have some God in it, right? But not everything is God in that sense. I think there is a division there. Well, I mean, it depends. I don't want to get too technical, but like, I'm looking at a quote here. The Stoics say that God is mixed with matter, pervading all of it, and so shaping it, structuring it, and making it into the world. It is like, it's mixed together. You couldn't separate them. It's not possible to separate them, but God is not everything at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we've established God. So there's this kind of this passive matter, this active principle that's mixed together with this passive matter, and everything has that, the mix of the two. God is associated with that active principle. So you think of it as the life force, the hot breath of the universe, the thing that gives it shape and structure and also preserves its shape and structure, stops humans from just like dissolving into sludge. That was the way I like to think about it. I don't know if the Stoics say that, but I think, the fact that I keep my form and I don't just fall apart is because of that active principle keeping me together. And so one thing that's important for the Stoics, and it's a really key part of their idea about God, is that this designing fire, so God, manifests in different forms. And these different forms have different names. So first there is tenor, and that's just the idea of just kind of structure. And so this is what you call God, really, when it manifests as just holding shape. So this is the form that holds together objects and objects that have no internal motion. So you can think of this as something like a rock. I can think of this like concrete metal that's holding up a building. This is still matter. It's still imbued with an active principle, even though it doesn't seem very active. And that active principle is causing it to retain its shape and form. Then You have physique, which is the next highest level. So this is kind of this natural ladder or hierarchy. And this is the form or the manifestation of God that allows for growth and reproduction, but no interaction with impressions. So this is what a plant is. The plant is responsive to its environment, but it's not conceptualizing impressions. Impressions aren't being implanted on a mind in any way. So the plant grows, it can reproduce, and that way it has physique, but it can't do anything more than that. Then the next highest level, and I should say, again, this material metaphor is really important because actually the active principle is kind of getting finer and finer. They actually thought it was a different type of matter that became more and more refined as you moved up this hierarchy. Then you've got the soul. So you've got kind of structure. You've got this physique, this ability to reproduce and grow and change. And then you've got a soul, this next finer level. And that's the form that can be influenced by impressions and change behavior accordingly. We can think of that like animals, cats, dogs, young human children. They have souls in this sense, and they receive impressions, and they respond to these impressions. These impressions are imprinted upon them, and they respond to them. And then at the highest level, you've got reason, or the commanding faculty. This is the most fine form of the active principle in the existing universe. And so this is the form that can deliberate on impressions. So humans have a soul, we receive impressions, but babies have souls, according to the Stoics, but they don't have reason. An adult has a soul, but has reason. So it can also actively reflect on its impression, make decisions. Say, I think that's true, or I don't think that's true, or I'm going to think about it a little bit longer. And so each of these were considered to be finer as we go up that ladder. So again, tenor, physique, soul, and reason. And the closer you get, the more refined you get, the closer you get to reason, the more you are like God, the closer you get to God. And they were actually thought that this reason, the active principle that comes with our reason was actually, I'm not sure, I can't tell if it's metaphorical or literal. But it's either the closest to God you can possibly get, and so they say you've got a part of God in you, or literally a part of the finest part of God existent in the universe, the most intelligent thing in the universe at the time. And this is why when you understand this, you'll see a bunch of quotes that will make reference to this about having a piece of God in you or a part of God in you, and that's what the Stoics are referring to, is referring to this very fine aspect of your active principle, this part of yourself, reason, that's very close to God. So one quote here, very famous one from Marcus Aurelius. He says, when you wake up in the morning, tell yourself, the people I deal with today will be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. They are like this because they can't tell good from evil. But I have seen the beauty of good and the ugliness of evil, and have recognized that the wrongdoer has a nature related to my own, not of the same blood or birth, but the same mind, and possessing a share of the divine. And so that's what Marcus means. He's referring to a specific technical idea in Stoicism. They possess a share of the divine. And what that means is their capacity to reason is like, it's a part of God that they have in them. Epictetus talks about this all the time too. Any thoughts on that kind of hierarchy of being?
I think it is interesting that before we move on to these ideas about how we have fragments of the divine in ourselves, others have the very same thing. I think it is interesting to note and spend some time on the fact that even ordinary physical objects, other creatures also contain aspects or fragments of God at these lower levels. And I think that, that's a really rich idea, and there's a lot of different directions one can take it. But I suppose there's at least that prompt to see, how do things exhibit order that the Stoics are pulling out, and also how do they have these aspects of providence or purpose built into them? How's that realized? How do things exemplify these lower levels of reason. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, two things to add to that is, like, one, you might think, which I'm not sure if this is a Christian idea of all fully or just kind of my understanding of Christianity. You might think, look, there's divine things and there's not divine things. Your divine thing and other things were made kind of to serve you or are a creation of God, but not a part of God. You're a creation of God. You're connected to God in some way. But there's this idea here of God is in these things, right? Like God is giving the plants their form and their movement, not just like God didn't set them up and then walk away. God is actively in them, manifesting in a certain form. Because I think it can be tempting to think that if you don't have a materialist view, you might think, well, humans have a soul, so we're special. But when you have this material view, it's like, no, all matter is matter. The soul isn't different. And in that, all matter is organized, governed, set into motion, structured by this life force, right? By this breath of the universe. And even the Stoics think that about ourselves, right? Like the Stoics will say, well, your stomach is physique, right? Like your stomach has movement and changes and adapts, but it doesn't respond to impressions. Or your bones have tenor, right? Your bones, they have structure and form that they hold. So it's like we contain that entire hierarchy within us, right? We have a soul, but then part of our soul has that reason. We share the fact that we have a soul with animals, but part of that soul has reason. So that's one idea, that there's not this kind of division or this type difference. The other part, though, that I guess I wanted to question here was, you were saying that, like, you know, the plants or the animals, they have a part of the divine too. But I think when the Stoics talk about the part of the divine, I think they mean like a very specific thing, which is that you have something in common with God. It's tough because obviously under this example, the plants do too, and the rocks do too. But there's this idea that, like, the fineness that you have in your reason, that's more godly than the plant. That's more godly than the rock. And there's something special. There's some divinely special status given to reason. These are not just descriptive differences. There is a hierarchy. Some are better than others. And I don't want to lose that either. Even though God pervades everything, we don't want to lose that hierarchy either.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. You have the ability to deliberate on impressions, I guess, carries with it the ability to see order, impose order, you know, give form to matter. You can talk about these different ways, intentionally create life, and so on, that I guess are closer to God from the Stoic view. I guess, you know, that maybe I'll toss that same issue back at you that I'm mulling over is, how do you, you know, why is reason at the top of this, you know, Stoic chain of being, if you will? You know, why is it closest to God?
Yeah, well, one quote here that I think just like shows the point that I'm trying to make. Epictetus is talking to his students and they ask him, well, you know, why are humans special? There's a paraphrase, and then quote, the student asks, is it not the case that animals too are works of God? And Epictetus responds, indeed they are, but they're not of primary value, nor are they portions of the divine. But you, for your part, are of primary value. You are a fragment of God. So just that really clear kind of type difference. As to where that hierarchy comes from, I'm not sure. Like, there seems to me almost this axiom that intelligence is better. Like, you almost get this, like, in all of Greek philosophy, and this is me taking off the top and trying to reason through it. There might be a better answer to this. But in all Greek philosophy, you get this kind of idea of telos, which something has its necessary function or purpose. I can climb a tree, but that's not my telos. It's not my ends. So I can do other things, but my best thing is to think, right? And so I think it's the same thing with God, which is like, it can do other things. It can maintain the shape of a rock. It can give a plant its growth and, you know, make make the sun burn and things like this, but it's the God is at its best when it's planning, when it's intelligent, and God's intelligence is understood in the way that it's prudentially, so intelligently designed the universe to be the best possible universe. And so in that sense, if God's telos is its intellect, then the most godly part of God is that intellect. And so we are closest to God if we are the most intelligent. That part of us is the most divine. That's my swing at it. What do you think?
I think that makes sense to me. That reason can animate matter, act on in a wider range of ways. It just goes back to these metaphors of the breath or dynamic fire. You know, think about what the Stoics are at least getting at there is reason has an ability to be this driving, organizing force, whether that's on the side of order, structuring the world, or in the sense of providence, you know, or a telos, fulfilling a specific purpose. And human beings, because of their rational ability, can order themselves, people around them, form order together and fulfill different purposes in a way that, say, an animal who is not as rational cannot. You know, they have, of course, this ability to be influenced by impressions and act on particular purposes, but the range is not as wide. They're not as capable of reasoning or developing new plans and so on. So perhaps I'm just restating what you did, but that's how I see it.
Yeah, we are the most godlike because we can do the things that are the best things God can do. And now, I mean, again, the kind of like, why is that the best thing? You end up with you kind of need to fall back on the telos or the function of the thing, or at least the way I do. And one thing I should say, we use reason a lot. I was just noticing you doing that in to substitute with God. That's not just to avoid God language. I think sometimes it can be tempting to avoid God language in our ethical discussions because God comes with a lot of baggage that can actually make things more confusing than if we say reason or nature. But the Stoics also identified God with logos, which is the word for, you know, reason, and nature. So these were kind of interchangeable concepts as well. So when we talk about God, reason, nature, the Stoics were using those ideas interchangeably, which tells you more about what they think of God than what they think of reason and nature. I think reason and nature stay pretty close, but it's actually, I think, moving the concept of God closer towards those two than it is the idea of moving nature further away from what it is, I would say. Understanding nature is just like all the things that are. Cool. So that's what God is, right? It's that breath, that life force of the universe. But one thing I wanted to get into is this interesting idea of conflagration, the total fire, and this cyclical nature of the universe. Because this is a really, I think, an important idea of the Stoic worldview, and it's an implication of having a material God. So a consequence of having a material God, and that God being a designing fire, is that eventually this fire will burn out. The Stoics think that it will come to the end of its natural cycle in a process called conflagration. The Greek for that is just ekpyrosis. Pyre being, you know, fire, ek, so what comes out of the fire, where everything becomes a total fire. Everything becomes, the entire universe burns basically and burns itself out. So Diogenes Laertius says, the Stoics also suppose that the world is perishable, since it is generated on the same principle as perceptible objects, and anything whose parts are perishable is perishable as a whole. So the universe is created, it goes about its does its thing for however many thousands, millions of years, and then eventually it burns out. And then at that moment of burning out, it again contracts, and it becomes a fiery sperm or soul. And so sperm is a funny metaphor, but it's not one we use in conversation anymore. But right, they mean this kind of point of origin of life, of creation. And then once it contracts, it expands again. So basically the universe burns out, it contracts into this sperm or soul of the universe, and then it unfolds again. And so the unfolding of the universe that we're now experiencing is the unfolding of God from this moment of contraction after the last conflagration, after the last burning out of the universe. And everything proceeds from this sperm or metaphorical point of origin in a perfect matter from this last burning out and contraction period. And the cycle kind of repeats indefinitely. So here's another quote on this. At certain fated times, the entire world is subject to conflagration and then is reconstituted afresh. But the primary fire is, as it were, a sperm, which possesses the principle of all things and the causes of all things, past, present, and future. The nexus and success of these is fate, knowledge, trust, and an inevitable and inescapable law of what exists. In this way, everything in the world is excellently organized as in a perfectly ordered society. So again, that's that idea of there's this cycle of it burns out, the universe burns out, it contracts into this singular point, and then it expands again, coming out from this point of origin, containing the principles of all things, past, present, and future, because there's this kind of unfolding of the universe that is following certain laws, and these are inescapable laws, and the universe unfolds in this perfect way, and the cycle kind of repeats itself indefinitely and eternally. I think that's kind of, it's kind of hardcore. It's kind of, it's an interesting worldview of the universe. I don't also to kind of bring it back to into a way that makes more sense to me. I don't know much about modern physics, but I think this kind of parallels with the Big Bang, if you know that idea, and the Big Crunch. And so the Big Crunch is this idea that entropy of the universe will cause motion to stop. And then at that point, like energy to fade out. And then at that point, gravity will kind of cause things to reverse, turn back in to a single point in the middle, the kind of densest point. And then maybe that moment, that would be the Big Crunch. And then the Big Crunch idea is that maybe that moment would cause another Big Bang, would cause the universe to kind of contract to a single point and then expand out again. So yeah, that's a lot, but I think this really interesting kind of world creation myth or story or idea that comes from the result of the universe being a material universe. And there's no kind of creation or creator that stands outside of it.
Mm-hmm. I suppose one aspect to highlight is many religions have a view of eschatology where the humankind is sort of barreling towards this end point, whether that's heaven or some other union with God, some sort of form of final justice. It's a single state, whereas Stoicism has more in common with worldviews that see everything in a deep sense as cyclical, as on a cycle, not heading towards a final state of being the best. In a sense, the Stoics believe things already are the best. They're just becoming, fulfilling, rolling out, continuing to cycle through. And that's, then there's nothing else to hope for.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know much about like Nietzsche's conception of eternal recurrence, but yeah, it is this view. I think that Stoic determinism can be hard to swallow sometimes. But it is a metaphysically this view that like things unfold in the best possible way. They then, with the past, the present, and the future being predetermined by the intelligence of God, they then burn out, reconstrict, and are reborn to do the exact same thing for eternity. So it is like a literal cycle. And it is not a cycle you can break. It is not a cycle you can step outside of. because you're a part of it, right? Because the parts that you would use to break out of it is your God-like reason, which God has already obviously accounted for in its creation of itself in its best possible form. I mean, sometimes I think that can seem demoralizing to people the same way determinism can, but I think that's there might be some ethical insights there if you really, some perspective insights if you take the time to digest it. But I think that's a kind of, it's very intense position to hold.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should touch on the problem of evil then. So I guess the question comes up, like, why, if the Stoics have this view, why do things often seem less than ideal? Why does it so often seem like that we don't live in the best possible world, but instead live in a world that's imperfect in a number of ways, tragic, people make terrible mistakes, decisions, and so on? What's the Stoic view on that?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of thing comes up whenever you end up with the issue of providence, whenever anybody says, the universe is good, and people respond to it. But I think when we're looking at this from a God angle, from what we talked about today, I think the way to respond to the problem of evil, why if the universe is determined by God and God is providential, intelligent, and good, why is there this struggle? I think the answer would have to be that, humans suffer because of our special ability and proximity to God, which is that, because we have this reflective ability, it allows us to live out of sync with our nature in a way that a rock, a plant, or even an animal couldn't, which is to say we have this kind of reflective capacity. And that reflective capacity is the Stoics would say, a good thing to have. You would never not want to have it. And when well actualized, it's the best possible thing for you and the best possible thing in the universe next to God itself. It's the most intelligent thing. But the consequence of being self-reflective is we have the ability to kind of self-reflect our way into ignorance, false beliefs, out of sync with the universe in a way. And so I think that would explain it. I mean, sometimes there's that explanation for the problem of evil, which is that, God gave us, often in a Christian view, it's this idea that God gave us free will. Even though we suffer because we have free will, it's better to have it than to not. And I think the Stoic answer might be something like that, but that it's better to be reflective than not, even if it causes us sometimes to suffer or to not live up fully to our potential. I'm not sure if that's fully satisfying, like any of the problem of evil answers are, but I think the Stoics would certainly think we are better off having this ability to reflect than the animals are, even if it leads us sometimes to vice and unhappiness.
Right, right. Yeah, and I suppose one other thought on this is that so much of what people think is evil on the Stoic view is not, of course. It concerns indifference, pleasure, pain, wealth, poverty, and so on. These are matters of, the situations, and what matters is navigating those situations skillfully. For the Stoic view, that's another aspect of their hardcore view, I suppose. But I think they put a question mark next to the idea that so much of the world is bad. Rather, what's less than ideal is often how we respond to it, and we have the ability to respond to the world how we choose. And I suppose that's part of the benefits and con of being rational animals, is of course that you can exercise that reason in good and bad ways.
Yeah. So there's that idea. I mean, I think that's exactly right. There's like, why is the problem of bad, I guess, which is why are there so many bad things? And the Stoic answer would be like, there are no bad things except vice. And then why is there vice? Well, because if there wasn't vice, there couldn't be virtue, because virtue comes with exercising your reason well. But yeah, I think directly right. Like, a lot of the bad things dissolve away, which again is a hardcore view, right? Like, tell that to the starving child or something like this, that, this is, again, it is that idea. This is part of God's plan. This serves a purpose. This is the best of possible worlds. It is that argument that you have to make to the starving child, which I don't think understandably doesn't sit right with many people. But if you were to go full Stoic in this view, if you were to have that full perspective shift, then you would not view it as a bad thing. You'd only view the bad thing as you're getting too upset about the starving child, because you're now living in accordance with nature or accepting things the way they are, which I think there is some truth to, right? You don't want to be getting too frustrated or too kind of bitter at these kind of things.
Yeah, thinking about how explaining evils to others, especially children, I think is a thorny problem. But at least you can see the Stoics explaining evil to themselves when you look at Marcus Aurelius, of course, and the different techniques he uses to sort of situate other people's vice or things he sees as imperfections, whether it's reminding himself that they're ignorant of the good, or that things serve and fit into this higher purpose. Often things have a part to play, even if that's not obvious immediately.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe another way into the problem.
Yeah, I guess the issue I'm running into is, like, it's all good and fine when it's like, you know, that awful person sitting at court with you, and, you know, Marcus is right. He's like, he's bad because he doesn't know the difference between good and evil, and so he's using his reason poorly. But it becomes, you know, when a volcano explodes and, you know, it kills 2,000 people and something like this. The issue with that, I could even see if humans were detached from the world, you might even go back to that telos argument for humans and say, well, you're a rational creature, do your best to rationalize the volcano. But when the volcano is also God, and God has also chosen at this moment to explode, you know, and take the form of molten lava, you know, whatever this silly metaphor is, it becomes harder to say, well, this is some sort of structure that we're not really picking up yet, or, you know, you have to go through that argument, right? You have to take the kind of Epictetus's argument, which is that Epictetus makes that argument about, I think this is Zeno he's quoting, you know, the foot would choose to be muddy if it understood it was part of the body, you know? And so you have to kind of connect it to a greater purpose or function, but it's really hard to see that greater purpose or function. I think even now, I'm just like leaving the world of people, because I think a lot of this stuff makes sense person to person. But when we get into the world of like famine, drought, it's weird to see that as, you know, the kind of Christian view I see sometimes of like God is mad at you and is punishing you, to me makes more sense than, well, this is the determined unfolding of the perfect universe. Well, where does that kind of stuff have to fit in that? That to me is confusing.
Yeah, I think it is confusing. It's challenging. In a real sense, I think it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
but at least I thought. It reminds me of there's a very short, beautiful essay by Schopenhauer that I love, which is on a sort of a short meditation on vice and the argument that people underrate how vicious people are. And then in the final paragraph, he says something to the effect of, but you should at least take solace in the fact that although many people are vicious, they're also miserable. So there's, the world is in a way its own kind of last judgment, bringing punishment onto the people who live in it. Very pessimistic, of course, but I think it also, it's what your remark about, you know, God being wanting to punish people, and that almost making more sense. It's a completely different kind of view of the nature of things, nature of evil, that's, you know, at least intuitively almost does make more sense than some of these views about, you know, here's a great tragedy, somehow things had to be this way.
Yeah, it's just like, why, you know, yeah, why couldn't God have done it differently? And what was the last thing I was gonna say with this? I think it's worth bringing up now, you know, at the very end of this episode, if made it to the end, maybe we could have another episode on this. But this hopefully makes this idea of living in accordance with nature seem a bit more clearer, or that it is living in accordance with nature, is living in accordance with reason, is living in accordance with God, which is basically aligning your beliefs to the way the world actually is, and aligning kind of what you value and your expectations and what you want to the approach to the universe as it unfolds. So, you know, learning to love your fate, that unfolding of the universe that's outside of your control, and then taking accountability and responsibility for perfecting the part of yourself that God has given you control over, made up to you, which is that ability to reason. And that is what it is to live in accordance with nature, which is to live in accordance with God, because God is that nature. God is that life force, those physical laws that imbues everything. And so that kind of ethical imperative, I think, makes more sense once there's some meat on the Stoic, meat on the bones of the Stoic view of God.
Yeah, I think it's can be motivating, especially these, you know, the lines from Epictetus or Seneca about, you know, how you are, how you have within you a fragment of the divine, and you ought to take care of that part of yourself. You know, you ought to have the self-respect to act like it. It can be motivating, for sure. And then of course reminding yourself that others too have that same fragment and deserve respect. And you ought to work with them as opposed to against them.
Yeah, that's nice. So I'm gonna try to summarize it as concisely as possible. Just to leave a quick summary of what we've talked about today. So the first is the idea that, Stoicism on God, or the Stoic God. So for the Stoics, God is a material active principle that imbues the universe. It's mixed together with the passive principle in all matter. You can think of this like a hot breath, the pneuma, the life force of the universe. Since this active principle is in everything, God is literally in or imbues all of the universe, ourself included. This active principle, God, provides form and function to the passive matter it imbues. It's what makes rocks have their structure, plants grow, animals have souls. It's also responsible for the physical world following physical causal laws and unfolding an intelligent, providential nature as the best of all possible worlds. But there is a hierarchy to the active principle, with humans commanding faculty at the top. We are the most godlike, and so we can be said to share a piece of the divine. This is metaphorical, though, as we talked about. Everything shares a piece of God. It's just that we have the most godlike part. We have the most fine active principle within us. As a physical substance moving towards entropy, God and the universe will eventually burn out into a state of pure fire called conflagration. After this conflagration, this fire contracts. And from this contraction, there is the sperm or soul of a new universe, which proceeds out again, much like the Big Bang. And this universe will likely be the same as our own, or at least very similar, and face the same conflagration later on in an infinite cycle of eternal repetition. And so that I think is a summary of the ideas we talked about today. Anything to finish us off, Caleb?
No, just to say, there you have it. That's the picture of the world you are living in. I hope you are listening carefully. Thanks for putting these notes together. I have a clear conception of the Stoic God, I think.
The truth of the matter has been revealed to me.
It's a good reminder. Yeah.
Thank you, Socrates. The thing that I'm going to leave with, it was a point that you made, Caleb. I mean, this has been helpful for me. But the point I'm going to leave with is that idea of that kind of connection with other things too. There's this connection with the animals and plants and the rest of the universe. Because there's this tendency to see ourselves. There is that one sense in which we are unique, special. We have a share of the divine. But there's also that sense in which we are connected with everything else in nature as well. And we don't want to see ourselves as too divided from that. That's the thing I'll be thinking about after this.
Excellent. Perfect. Well, I think that's a great spot to end.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for listening to Stoic Conversations. Please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and share it with a friend. If you want to dive deeper still, search Stoa in the App Store or Play Store for a complete app with routines, meditations, and lessons designed to help people become more stoic. And I'd also like to thank Michael Levy for graciously letting us use his music. You can find more of his work at ancientliar.com. And finally, please get in touch with us. Send a message to stoa@stoameditation.com if you ever have any feedback, questions, or recommendations. Until next time.